Today is Tuesday, May 15th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, violence engulfs the Gaza Strip as U.S. opens its embassy in Jerusalem.
This city and its entire nation is a testament to the unbreakable spirit of the Jewish people.
A second family stages a suicide bomb attack in Indonesia. The U.S. Supreme Court overturns a ban on states betting on sporting events. Also ahead, Rwandan children are fondly remembering the soon-to-be royal bride, Meghan Markle. It's all on today's International Edition. Israeli forces killed dozens of Palestinians on the Gaza border Monday as clashes and protests coincided with the deeply controversial opening of the U.S. Embassy in Jerusalem. For Israelis, it marked the first official recognition of Jerusalem as their capital after 70 years. But the move infuriated Palestinians who seek the eastern part of that city that that Israel captured in the 1967 Mideast War as their future capital. Tens of thousands gathered near the border in protest. But the embassy inauguration went on as planned, attended by a Washington delegation that included White House aides Jared Kushner and his wife, Ivanka Trump.
On behalf of the 45th President of the United States of America, we welcome you officially and for the first time to the embassy of the United States here in Jerusalem, the capital of Israel.
Well, the ceremony also included a recorded message by President Trump.
Our greatest hope is for peace. The United States remains fully committed to facilitating a lasting peace agreement.
The clashes also left hundreds of Palestinians wounded in what was the bloodiest day in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict since the 2014 Gaza War. Joining us now to talk about the volatile situation is Hadi Amer, former deputy envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in the Obama administration and currently a fellow with the Brookings Institution. What is your initial thought on what we've been witnessing?
First of all, the situation in the Gaza Strip is an ongoing man-made humanitarian catastrophe where 2 million people are penned in and where the unemployment rate is higher than anywhere on earth, where per capita incomes have been declining, where 97% of the water is unfit for human consumption, and where there's only 4 hours of electricity every day in a highly urban area. So that's the backdrop. What the Trump administration did is sort of an affront to diplomacy 101. So half of the people in Greater Israel, Greater Palestine are Jews, half are Palestinian Arabs. What the Trump administration did is embrace one side of the narrative fully and disregard the aspirations, hopes, and dreams of the other side. And as a result, there is predictable ongoing anger.
Dozens of people killed by Israeli police soldiers on the border. A lot of outcry from around the world, a lot of concern, a lot of disagreement with the U.S. decision to move the embassy. Where does it go from here? You know, the Trump administration, Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump all talking about how they want peace. And contrary to that, a lot of people are saying, well, the U.S. is no longer a neutral, objective negotiator, so it's really not possible for the U.S. to have any say in it. Plus, if we're talking about the disputed area that both want for their capital, where does that leave things?
Look, everybody wants peace. Unfortunately, what we have is a White House that has political novices at the helm, and they are making unwise decisions that are taking the both at the one hand, angering one side of the equation, embracing the other side, and in doing that, it's sort of largely taking the U.S. out of play moving forward. So it's a tragic and predictable situation. Any serious observer, any seasoned diplomat would have advised the Trump administration not take these steps. Having served in the administration, I know that. I know that every seasoned long-term career professional would have advised against these steps.
Do you expect to see more violence and turmoil going forward? Do you think this is something that'll blow over?
My concern is that for decades, Israelis and Palestinians have been dying needlessly. Unfortunately for the Palestinians, the vast, vast majority of those deaths are on the Palestinian side of the equation. I think whatever happens, whatever pathway is charted forward, unfortunately, the United States is going to be less and less relevant to how that moves forward. The United States will just is no longer going to be accepted by Palestinian states, by Arab states, as an honest broker, or even by Muslim-majority countries. We see the Turks recalling their ambassador from Washington over this. So it's a deeply unfortunate situation. I'm not there on the ground in Gaza, so I can't attest to who's right and who's wrong. But what we know is there are dozens of Palestinian deaths occurring on an ongoing basis on one side of the equation. And so I think, you know, it would be wise for the Israeli government to look at its engagement strategies to kind of mitigate the loss of life.
The White House said that the deaths that have occurred, the blame falls squarely in the hands of Hamas.
Look, I mean, having served in the U.S. government, I know that the United States does not have, we do not have extensive staff on the ground in Gaza. So we do not have the operational intelligence to know exactly what is going on in Gaza. So wherever the blame lies, it always takes two to tango, and there is a way for both parties to calm the situation. It's true that Hamas could, I'm sure, do things to calm the situation, but it's also true that the government of Israel could do things to control the situation. But let's remember, this is not just a Hamas-driven protest. This is a civil society protest that Hamas has gotten behind and support, but it is a protest generated by ordinary Palestinians against their situation, again, against having the highest unemployment rate in the world, against having 4 hours a day of electricity in a highly urban area, against having 95% of their water being unfit for human consumption, against having, you know, the vast majority of their sewage flowing untreated into their ground aquifer and into the seas. It is a catastrophic situation in Gaza that has been ongoing, and anyone looking closely at the situation could have, should have predicted that this was a tinderbox just waiting for a match to light it on fire. And my concern is that the Trump administration has poured fuel on that fire. The 2 million people that live in the Gaza Strip are effectively ordinary people seeking to live ordinary lives with ordinary hopes and dreams. And you have to ask yourself if you would be willing to tolerate the situation that they have lived in. It's just clear that something's got to give in Gaza, and it was perfectly predictable that something like this would happen.
That's Hattie Ammer, former deputy envoy for Israeli-Palestinian negotiations in the Obama administration and currently a fellow with the Brookings Institution. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. A Kenya court has rejected a plea for equal property rights in divorce. U.S. and China officials are gathering in D.C. in hopes of averting a trade war. Melania Trump has a successful procedure for a kidney condition. And a U.S. diplomat involved in a fatal crash leaves Pakistan. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. In a surprising overture to China, President Trump tweeted Sunday that he would help ZTE Corp, a major supplier of telecom networks and smartphones based in southern China, to get back into business, saying too many jobs in China are at stake after the U.S. government cut off access to its American suppliers. White House spokesman Raj Shah was asked about it at Monday's press briefing.
It's an issue of high concern for China that's been raised with the U.S. with the U.S. government and with our administration at various levels. So the president has asked Secretary Ross to look into it consistent with applicable laws and regulations.
U.S. Commerce Department last month blocked ZTE from importing American components for 7 years. The U.S. accused ZTE of misleading American regulators after it settled charges for violating sanctions against North Korea and Iran. Douglas Jacobson is an export and sanctions attorney who represents suppliers that do business with ZTE. VOA Asia's Ira Melman asked Jacobson for his reaction to the U.S. president's tweet.
This has caught all of those in the export controls and sanctions world certainly by surprise and with some degree of shock and awe. This is unprecedented that the President of the United States would intervene in what really is a law enforcement case.
Isn't there another side to that story in that this company had apparently done things to, for want of a better term, hurt the U.S. economically as far as the way it has done business?
ZTE was actually caught red-handed by acquiring U.S. products, using those in their devices manufactured in China, and then they were sold to embargoed countries by the United States, including Iran, North Korea, etc. And so they were caught by the United States. There were the Bureau of Industry and Security of the Commerce Department issued documents that they had actually found in ZTE's possession, indicating this scheme to violate U.S. sanctions. And ultimately, ZTE was placed 2 years ago on a denial order, and that was temporarily gave a temporary reprieve. And ultimately, the company settled in March of 2017 for they pled guilty to violating U.S. export controls and sanctions laws, and also had to pay a total penalty of nearly $1.2 billion. The latest salvo was in mid-April, so only 4 weeks ago, where the Commerce Department denied ZTE's export privileges because they, BIS, alleged that ZTE did not abide by their end of the settlement agreement. So BIS invoked the denial order, which is the harshest penalty under U.S. law, and as a result, U.S. companies could no longer sell U.S. origin items to ZTE. And as a result, ZTE, since they were so dependent on U.S. software and hardware, they have stated recently that they really cannot continue to do business. And as a result, they've been trying to appeal this case to the Commerce Department, and this certainly has gotten the attention of senior political leaders in China and in the United States, and that's led to President Trump's tweet.
Do you think this is signaling a thaw in trade relations between the United States and China?
No, I think this is an independent case that really has to be looked at on its own. And I think this really is delinked from all of the other trade-related issues on the tariffs, on the aluminum, on steel, and on intellectual property. On March 7th, 2017, Secretary of Commerce Ross said in a press release that this investigation and this unprecedented penalty reflects ZTE's egregious scheme to evade U.S. law and systematically mislead investigators. So for them to now do a 180 on that tough talk, I think really indicates President Trump's willingness to perhaps make a concession to China in exchange perhaps for China's assistance with the North Korea situation and to make concessions perhaps in other trade areas.
And has made you a happy man today.
My clients, if this proceeds, I think that they certainly will be pleased. And I think it obviously makes ZTE happiest of all. The parties that are going to be unhappy, however, I think this is going to be the real interesting fallout of how U.S. law enforcement, who has been taking a very hard line on ZTE and other companies who violate U.S. export controls and sanctions, how they are going to react given that the president basically going over their head and intervening in really what's essentially a law enforcement case.
Douglas Jacobson is an export and sanctions attorney. Indonesia is stepping up security in the world's largest Muslim nation after a series of suicide attacks involving members of two families in the country's second largest city of Surabaya. Monday, four members of one family riding on two motorbikes died after they detonated explosives outside police headquarters, wounding several police and passersby. An 8-year-old girl survived the blast. Sunday, a family of six, including two girls ages 9 and 12, died in separate attacks on three Christian churches, killing at least 13 other people and wounding dozens. That attack was claimed by an Islamic State-inspired group. Another three members of one family died and two wounded when a bomb exploded Sunday in an apartment complex near the city. President Joko Widodo, also known as Jokowi, condemned the attacks as barbaric and vowed to root out and destroy Islamic militants. Greg Feely is an associate professor at the Australian National University, who specializes in Islam, politics, and terrorism in Indonesia. He told VOA's Victor Beatty such incidents involving families is unprecedented in Indonesian jihadism.
I'm not aware of any other cases globally quite like this. We've had brothers, adult brothers and the like, who, that have undertaken suicide bombings together, but not entire families.
Is there an uptick in jihadism in Indonesia?
Not particularly, in fact. There's certainly quite a few thousand supporters of the Islamic State, of ISIS, in Indonesia. But they have been, until now, very well contained by the Indonesian police. The Indonesian police have a very effective counter-terrorism policing operation, and they have arrested well over 1,000 people in the last 15, 16 years, and successfully prosecuted many of those people for terrorism offences. And almost every day they are uncovering new cells, new operations, arresting people. So they have done remarkably well. But nonetheless, we unfortunately know that they can't catch everyone. And in this particular case, the family seem to have quite successfully evaded detection. And the father was the head of a local branch of a pro-ISIS organization called JAD, but he had no terrorism convictions. The police knew that he'd been to Syria, but had been deported. He and his family had been there, but they hadn't been able to charge him on it because in Indonesia, being a foreign fighter is not an offense.
President Joko Widodo was quick to visit the scene of the attacks. He said this act is barbaric and beyond the limits of humanity, causing victims among members of society, the police, and even innocent children.
The revulsion that he expressed at the nature of this attack, I think, is shared very widely across Indonesian society. Even very conservative Islamic organizations are coming out and condemning this attack with strong language. The very notion that parents could sacrifice their own children in this way is utterly repugnant to most Indonesians. And so it's hard to imagine that this is anything other than an extremely counterproductive jihadist action by this family. Whether they thought of things in strategic terms, but usually terrorists will try to not kill fellow Muslims, they'll try to kill people who are non-Muslims or people who are working for the state. But in this particular case, to kill your own family members, that's something that most people are utterly repulsed by.
That's Greg Feely, Associate Professor at the Australian National University. You're listening to International Edition on VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning in to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/sunny. It's the sunny side of sports right here on the Voice of America.
VOA's International Edition continues. A decision by the U.S. Supreme Court means American sports fans will soon have many more places to place legal bets on the results of football, baseball, basketball, and other games. The court struck down a 1992 federal ban on state-authorized sports gambling, with some exceptions. Joining us now to talk more about this is Casey Clark, Vice President of Strategic Communications with the American Gaming Association. Thanks for being with us. What is your reaction to this decision?
It's been a great day in terms of what this means for us. You know, the court took a case that was a long shot that where New Jersey was trying to implement legalized sports betting, and the states, they were sued by the professional sports leagues, and the Supreme Court took the case and found today that that federal oversight and overreach is unconstitutional, and that, that states should be allowed to determine for themselves whether or not they want to regulate and provide legalized sports gaming. So a lot of good opportunity for states to now implement policies that might make sense for their constituents.
Is this sort of the equivalent to legalized gambling?
What it really does is get federal prohibition that has kind of failed significantly over the past 25 years. It eliminates the federal prohibition. So it doesn't in and of itself legalize anything other than legalizing states and tribal sovereign nations' rights to decide whether they want to pass or implement legal regulated gaming. So it gives them an opportunity to introduce new kind of gaming. It doesn't necessarily do that on its own.
Up until now, what was the case?
Until now, full-fledged sports betting was only available in Nevada. The federal law was passed in 1992 that basically froze sports betting where it was. So Nevada offered full-scale sports betting at the time. They were kind of grandfathered in, as were a couple other states, but Delaware being one among them, that they didn't offer the kind of sports betting that you could do in a sports book in Nevada right now. So it's all been restricted there.
What could this do for state economies?
It could be huge. We just put some loose numbers together based on a standardized tax rate. But since every state's going to be implementing their own policy, it should be different. But if every state legalized sports betting at a standard tax rate at 15%, it could generate around $8 billion in total tax impact in terms of property tax, sales tax, employment tax, and direct taxation of the gaming itself. So huge upside for states and the federal government, too.
I know that Major League Baseball officials released a statement very concerned about the decision, saying they'll do everything they can to keep the integrity of the game. What do you think their concerns are, and are any of them valid?
It surprises me a little bit. Major League Baseball, along with the NBA and some other leagues, have been very front-footed on looking for opportunities to pass statewide sports betting, legalizing sports betting legislation. I think that we all share a concern for the integrity of the game and for the athletes who participate in them. So I think we kind of agree that that's got to be the utmost attention, the thing we have to pay the most attention to. I don't think there's any way to do that in an illegal black market, which is what we have now. So bringing this above board and creating regulations and an oversight and creating oversight over this thing will actually provide better protection than you have now.
That's Casey Clark, Vice President of Strategic Communications with the American Gaming Association. Children in rural Rwanda have a personal connection to former American actress Meghan Markle, who will become royalty when she ties the knot with Prince Harry on May 19th. As a global ambassador for the Christian humanitarian organization World Vision, Markle visited Rwandan villages where the charity is expanding access to clean water. VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo reports.
Whether it's filling their cups or water bottles or simply putting their heads under the tap to cool off, elementary school children in the Gatsibo district enjoy the clean water. They say they are honored and grateful for the charitable work of the American actress and soon-to-be royal, Meghan Markle.
Markle brought us the water we use. We now have drinking water and water to do other things.
While visiting Rwanda with World Vision 2 years ago, Markle toured the Gatsibo district where a piped water project funded by the organization provided safe drinking water. Josepha Nyanga says Markle had a profound impact on her village.
She used to come here and bring us clean water. She really cared about the people here. We would use the clean water and wouldn't get sick anymore.
One student hopes royalty doesn't change her desire to help people.
Being part of a royal family is an exceptional thing. I encourage and hope that she will continue helping poor people in the world, regardless of whether they are Africans or white.
More than 130 families have benefited from the water project. Most expressed gratitude and wished Markle the fairy tale life they say she deserves.
As a new princess, I wish her a happy family. I wish that she respects and loves her husband during all their life until the end.
Markle ended her role with World Vision shortly before announcing her engagement to Prince Harry, but many here are hopeful the British monarchy's next royal member will continue her humanitarian work. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
Margot Kidder, the Canadian actress who starred as a salty and cynical Lois Lane opposite actor Christopher Reeve in the Superman film franchise of the 1970s and 1980s, has died. Kidder, as an ace reporter, Lane was a salty, sexually savvy adult who played off the boyish farm-raised charm of Reeve's Clark Kent, though her dogged journalism constantly got her into dangerous scrapes that required old-fashioned rescues.
Well, let's start with your vital statistics. Are you married?
No, I'm not.
Do you have a girlfriend?
No, I don't, but if I did, Miss Lane, you'd be the first to know about it.
Superman was a superhero blockbuster 2 decades before the comic book movies became the norm at the top of the box office. Margot Kidder was 69 years old. You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. We thank you so much for joining us. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Speaking at the Organization of American States, Vice President Mike Pence quoted the charter of the OAS. Representative democracy is an indispensable condition for stability, peace, and development. Free nations throughout the hemisphere, he stated, can attest to that truth. But there are places in the hemisphere under a dark cloud of tyranny, Vice President Pence said, among them Cuba, where the police state imposed by the Castro family remains, and Nicaragua, where hundreds of thousands have taken to the streets to demand a return to democratic order, only to be met in some instances with deadly force. It is in Venezuela, however, where the tragedy of tyranny is on full display. Grinding poverty, corruption, oppression, and exile are the results of authoritarian misrule by President Nicolas Maduro, who has replaced the country's once great democracy with dictatorship. If the Venezuelan people had the chance, they would choose a better path. The vice president called the upcoming May 20th elections in Venezuela a fraud and a sham. The regime callously portions out access to affordable food to manipulate votes. The courts and the electoral council are packed with Maduro cronies. Major parties have been banned, opposition leaders have been barred from running, and dissidents jailed.
And that's why today we call on Maduro and his regime, suspend this sham election. Give the people of Venezuela real choices, because the Venezuelan people deserve to live in democracy once again.
Vice President Pence noted that in order to hold the Maduro regime responsible for the chaos it has caused, the U.S. has imposed, among other measures, strict financial sanctions on more than 50 current and former senior officials and has barred the Petro digital currency from the U.S. financial system. Vice President Pence called on nations in the Western Hemisphere to do more to stand with Venezuela's people by suspending Venezuela from membership in the organization, cutting off Venezuela's corrupt leaders from laundering money through their country's financial systems, and enacting visa restrictions that prevent Venezuela's leaders from entering their nations. The people of Venezuela deserve democracy, Mr. Pence said. The people of Venezuela deserve to regain their libertad.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.